You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, June 3rd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Dave Zirin on his new book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. Also on the program, more on that EPA ruling, or new regulations, I should say, and the right wings found their new Benghazi. And conveniently enough, it starts with a B. Even the gun crazies are too crazy for the gun crazies, as the NRA begs their membership not to act like a-holes. Meanwhile, in Texas, where men are men and women are women, you can't get a sandwich at Big Earl's. And the heartwarming story of Chiquita Banana, who they don't want any ability for 9/11 victims' families to sue companies who are any way associated with terrorist organizations because, you know, bananas. And terrorism. What are you going to do? Hi, folks. So, still figuring out how you can listen to the 3 to 6 show that I'm doing, Sam Steeter, Ring of Fire, which is on nationally. If you are not one of those 20 or some odd cities that have a local affiliate, you can listen via the TuneIn app to the show. You should be able to find it there. And as we get more information, I hope you understand that this is, it's just, it is, this obviously happened very quickly. As of Thursday morning, we did not have a studio, nor additional producers. And so we're still putting it all together. It has been hectic to say the least. And, you know, there's all sorts of mishigas when you get involved in terrestrial radio. But,
as so many of you know.
Yes, indeed. Indeed, it's
a collective sigh from the audience as they exactly, all reflect on their individual radio careers.
Yes. Well, I think people know my travails with Air America enough to know that things don't always go as you are led to believe they will go. So,
I was listening right on my computer from TuneIn. TuneIn.com. They have the Progressive Voices channel right there. You could find it and just listen on your computer. If you're at work, in your cubicle or wherever, and you're at
that's
a computer.
Right. And if your local affiliate's not carrying the show, by all means, tell them to carry the show. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Dave Zirin.
We'll be right back.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program writer for The Nation magazine, proprietor of edgeofsports.com, and author of his latest, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. Dave Zirin, welcome back to the program.
Oh, great to be here, Sam. Thanks for having me.
So, Dave, I mean, I say this every time you come on, but it bears repeating. You are the best, in my opinion, writer about how sports is so intertwined, not just with our society, but our politics. And you really lift the veil of what's going on underneath the surface of what fills the sports page of our newspapers and media across the board. And why Brazil?
Wow. I mean, Brazil, it started for me looking at Brazil because I've been writing about the Olympics and the World Cup for years. And here's Brazil getting the 2014 World Cup and then Rio hosting the 2016 Olympics. And when you couple that with the fact that Brazil, of course, has been for some time a rising economy, competing on the global stage, now the fifth largest economy on the planet, it seemed like a book that would be fascinating to write, to actually travel down to Rio, go through Brazil and see how the planning was going on. Because I've seen in all these locations the ways in which the debt builds up, the way public space gets militarized, and the way people get displaced from their homes. That happens wherever these mega events find purchase. And I was curious what would happen in Brazil. What I didn't expect was the largest mass movement that Brazil had seen since the fall of the dictatorship 30 years ago. I didn't expect a million people in the streets. I didn't expect people raising slogans against the World Cup in Brazil, a country that is so synonymous with soccer. And that is really what the book became. I mean, the book is like a narrative of trying to explain to a United States audience that might not know the first thing about Brazil beyond Pelé, and explain to them why in Brazil, this pinnacle soccer nation, people are protesting the World Cup.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because you go into I think you do a great job of talking about how how soccer, we call it, is so intertwined with Brazilian culture, and that the Brazilians almost developed their, like, they in some ways they revolutionized the sport, or they developed their own sort of, you can actually talk about a Brazilian style of soccer, or maybe arguably you could have. Talk about that.
No, absolutely. I think this is the toughest thing for people outside of Brazil to really understand is, so let's start with this because it might make more sense. What made the United States self-conscious as a nation? It was the throwing off of the British throne in the American Revolution, and it was the Civil War to abolish slavery. And then you could argue as well, you know, the civil rights movement being the completion in many respects of the Civil War in the smashing of Jim Crow. So that's what made the U.S. self-conscious of itself as a nation. What made Brazil self-conscious of itself as a nation? Well, there was never a Brazilian revolution against Portuguese royalty. And there was never a civil war to end slavery, even though Brazil had a slave system that dwarfed that of the United States, both in terms of its numbers and its brutality. So what made Brazil self-conscious of itself? One of the things was soccer. And soccer, particularly because soccer was something that in a very racist society, soccer became a source of tremendous pride for the entire nation, precisely because it was so influenced by African and Afro-Indigenous players. And so this thing that you describe, Sam, the Brazilian style, is internationally renowned the way French cuisine. I mean, it is like a brand of a style of play that speaks to beauty and grace and an ability the likes of which other countries only aspire to. And its roots have very much to do with influences of capoeira, that's the, you know, the martial art dance that slaves in Brazil started as a way to disguise rebellions. And it also had to do with the fact that in a country that abolished slavery but still had this tremendous legacy of white supremacy, black and brown players made every effort not to touch their opponents when they played soccer, particularly if their opponents were white. So this effort to actually avoid physical contact was something that soccer had never really seen before. Mm. And it, you know, you need rhythm, you need balance, you need all kinds of certain abilities that the game had yet to see. So that's Brazilian soccer. And one of the reasons why I think that there are these protests today is that, and this shocks people to hear this, but that Brazilians are becoming alienated from this sport that they love, precisely because Brazilian soccer has become just another commodity for export, branding, and people can there isn't public space to play like there used to be. People can't afford to go into the stadium to see the World Cup. And I think that there's this anger that exists because people feel alienated from this thing that's so precious to them.
Let's talk about those two aspects of the lack of public space, the public space that has been essentially in many respects privatized, and the changes to the stadium where the World Cup will take place. But let's, before we get there, just tell us, you know, who is FIFA, and these protests really started over a year ago, I guess now. Talk about who FIFA is and why the protests were so surprising in the context of what has happened in Brazil in terms of their economy.
No, absolutely. I mean, FIFA, as it's known, is the international rulemaking governing body of soccer. It's one of the most cloistered and secretive societies in the world, and it is an absolute never-ending cavalcade of scandal and corruption and all the rest of it. And FIFA was very excited to bring the World Cup to Brazil precisely because of the promises that Brazil made. I mean, Brazil, when they won the World Cup with the then-president Lula and Pelé by his side, made promises to build new stadiums, build, as they say, FIFA-quality stadiums. And they made promises to do all kinds of infrastructure, VIP treatment, everything that FIFA loves to hear. And that's why this World Cup is going to be more expensive than the previous three combined, with a price tag that keeps going higher and higher.
Wow.
Now what's happened, though, is that people are in the streets saying, using that slogan about FIFA-quality stadiums and saying, well, we want FIFA-quality wages. We want FIFA-quality hospitals. And one of the problems that FIFA has, first of all, there's this anger in Brazil because FIFA is seen as yet another European plunderer coming into the country and making their hay. The other thing is that the Brazilian economy has slowed down in the last several years. FIFA doesn't care about that. I mean, this is when FIFA gets really gangster, Sam. Like, I'm sure you've seen the movie Goodfellas. Do you remember the scene where Henry Hill does the thing about, you know, bleep you, pay me, bleep you, pay me? It's like, oh, your wife is sick, bleep you, pay me. Oh, you're having troubles, bleep you, pay me. That's what happens to FIFA. So Brazil says, hey, there are protests in the country. FIFA says, bleep you, pay me. Brazil says, hey, maybe we shouldn't build all new stadiums. Maybe we should use some of the ones we have, bleep you, pay me. And this is what's so interesting about what this moment, Sam, is that FIFA, which has always been, you know, Eduardo Galeano, the great Latin American writer, described them as invisible dictators. They're really being dragged into the light with these protests, and that's what makes this moment, I think, very historic.
There's a quality of FIFA that is sort of like what we understand, the sort of what the World Bank was doing for a long time, right? I mean, it's sort of just leveraging and sort of supposedly this is, I mean, And you call it, I think, a Trojan horse for neoliberal assaults. In other words,
a neoliberal Trojan horse.
Yeah, tell us what that means, because there's all these promises that come, and this is analogous to, hey, we're going to build a stadium downtown, and we're going to do it with taxpayer monies, and everybody's going to benefit. And talk about like what FIFA has come in and done, and what we should say, Lula and Dilma as well, socialist workers' parties have promised these guys.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, this is another reason why I think American audiences should be paying close attention to what's happening, because you look at the Rust Belt of the United States, you know, Cleveland, Detroit, Milwaukee, where you have these new publicly funded stadiums with all these promises, yet what do they end up creating? Well, they end up being these huge givebacks to the wealthy. It ends up being these monuments to corporate welfare, and they end up actually adding to wealth inequality and class stratification in the United States. FIFA operates under a very sort of similar way, except it's writ much larger, especially with something like the World Cup, because it encompasses the entire country. And please keep in mind, Brazil is bigger than the continental United States. So you have FIFA coming in here and laying down dictatorial edicts to a country that only overthrew their own dictatorship 30 years ago. And they're coming in and dictatorially saying where money needs to be spent, what kind of security needs to happen. There need to be drones flying overhead. There need to be 1,000 street cameras in Rio alone. And putting down, like really their foot down on the necks of the country itself. Now, yes, that neoliberal Trojan horse. I mean, that's because when FIFA comes in, then the government, in this case, as you mentioned, the Workers' Party, they push through a lot of projects and objectives that they otherwise would never be able to get away with. But they can do so, or at least attempt to do so. They're getting called on it right now. But they do so Trojan horse style, because people are either so excited by the World Cup or the nationalism of hosting this international event that people who would otherwise protest don't say a word. And I saw this with my own eyes in South Africa. And the protests in South Africa only happened after the World Cup ended in 2010. Everybody went home and the bill came due. This time we're seeing it in advance. Now, you mentioned the Workers' Party. And, I mean, you know, for years, you know, Lula has been called, you know, by the business press, you know, the IMF's favorite president. And a lot of this story has to do with what the United States did in the wars and occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Because while George W. Bush is spending $1 trillion on these occupations, where was the money of the world being parked? It was being parked in the Brazilian stock market, which went up over like 600% over the course of a decade. When the 2008 recession happened, Lula was asked about it, and he said, well, what recession? That's Bush's recession. That has nothing to do with Brazil. I mean, not even a hiccup. And they really thought that they could ride this kind of like the commodities boom and the discovery of oil and the influx of all this foreign cash. They thought they could ride it to also hosting the World Cup and the Olympics back-to-back and have it be this huge showcase for the country. But there's only one problem, Sam, is that economies do slow down.
Right.
And it's with the slowdown and everybody's raised expectations for what the World Cup and the Olympics would bring where we end up at this moment.
I mean, you refer to this as opposed, or maybe not as opposed, but as a almost like a complement to the notion of the shock doctrine of disaster capitalism. As celebration capitalism, that this privatization, the security cameras, all these things sort of come in a moment of national pride and euphoria and high hopes, and then they still are there after the fact.
Yeah, and I'll never forget hearing a sheriff in a town outside of London. Or some law enforcement official. Like, I asked him what would happen to the Olympic street cameras that were put up just for the 2012 games. And he said to me, well, it's not like we can just put them back in the box, can we? So it becomes like this mission creep thing where it's like, it's very hard to put that wine back in the bottle. But I had the good fortune to speak to Naomi Klein about this very issue. You know, she's the author of The Shock Doctrine and talks about the ways in which natural disasters from Katrina to the tsunami in Southeast Asia are used to put on neoliberal shock reforms. And we both saw these similarities. Like, it's not as extreme as a post-tsunami shock reform. But what it is it's still very effective. And it also allows big business, the government, the oligarchs in Brazil's case, to manage the shock therapy much more, in their mind, rationally. Because what are you going to do, sit around and wait for the next tsunami? I mean, if you're looking at this prime Rio real estate and you want to grab it from the people who live there in the favelas, the poorest communities, what do? I mean, getting a major sporting event is a terrifically and ruthlessly effective pretext for pursuing some of these same reforms.
Let's talk about some of these exclusion zones. What are those?
Oh, man. I mean, the exclusion zones, they're creating areas that are very stratified by class, particularly in Rio and Sao Paulo, around the stadium for purposes of security, which is, this is the craziest thing, is that the game's in Brazil, and they're creating a World Cup that Brazilians are largely not going to attend. And they're actually creating these huge zones. They say they're doing it to ward against terrorists, and sometimes they say they're doing it to ward against protesters. Those words, by the way, in Brazil used very interchangeably. And they're even passing a law, like they're trying to pass a law, that for the course of the World Cup, protesting would be an act akin to terrorism. Which, once again, for people, that's a nasty echo of the dictatorship that they just got rid of less than 30 years ago. So, but to bring it back to the exclusion zone, here's a little compare and contrast. When the finals of the 1950 World Cup, which were played in Rio, were at the Maracanã, their tremendous stadium, 225,000 people were there in the stadium. And there's roughly one-tenth of the city of Rio was in attendance that day. Now, not only has the Maracanã been whittled down so it only seats 75,000 people because they took out the open seating at the top and replaced it with these luxury boxes, but now, of course, because of these exclusion zones, you're not even going to go anyway if you're just a regular carioca, a regular person who lives in Rio.
I mean, in some way, it really is seems to be destroying that relationship between Brazilians and soccer. I mean, not just the sort of, but I mean, over the years, of course, we've seen this in sort of baseball stadiums where you like the bleachers, which used to be the way that like, you know, you could take your kids to a game and it wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't cost you a week's salary, essentially, is gone. This is the same dynamic.
Well, I'm feeling this because I just took my son to his first Orioles game. And when I saw that hot dogs were $9,
right?
I mean, I almost fell over. Like a $9 hot dog. I mean, this like, how are you supposed to, you know, raise your kids on some of those same traditions and have some of those same moments if it's so prohibitive cost wise? It's just a mess. But this is it is a very similar compare and contrast, and it has to do with who sports is for. It also has to do with how sports are funded in the 21st century, because if the main funding of sports is now sweetheart cable deals and corporate welfare and these luxury boxes, well, then there's very little dependence of the guardians of sport on working class fans. I mean, so because it's not like the owners when you and I were kids, Sam, were nicer people, but they needed our butts in the seats if they were going to make some money.
Right.
And they don't really need our butts in the seats anymore. I mean, they need it more for anything, for scenery. Because it would be very embarrassing, like if you have a World Series game, for example, and the stadium's only half filled. So, like, they need us, but they need us to be more part of the show than they need us for their financial well-being.
Let's talk a little bit about these World Cup courts too, because this is another thing that you just wonder what will remain. I mean, this dynamic of the development of like these security measures and these sort of extrajudicial measures, it just reminds me a little bit of what was developed when we had the RNC in New York City in 2004, and the sort of like the things like the kettling nets and the free speech zones and all of that, which then we start to see become just not extraordinary measures, but daily measures. You know, when we saw it obviously with Occupy, but we see it now at any type of event, this idea of cordoning off people and kettling them. And these World Cup courts, that just strikes me as something that's not going to go away. But describe what those are,
right?
Because it's sort of stunning.
Right, right. I mean, I'm no expert on the courts, but the main point of the World Cup courts are they're setting up a judicial process that can basically assembly line people who are arrested, either in protest. They say it's also to guard against fights, and but they want to be able to do basically mass convictions for the purposes of getting people off of the streets. And, yeah, no, that is very frightening. I mean, it's very frightening when a stadium is built in the Amazon that'll likely never be used after this World Cup, and the politician says, well, it can be used as an open-air prison processing center. You know, these are scary things, and it's and this is part of the whole neoliberal Trojan horse idea, because if they just said openly, it's like, hey, we're going to build a mass prison processing center, we're going to start a mass conviction process as well with these new special courts, then people would be like, hell no. But when you do it because you say you're planning for the World Cup, you have a much greater chance of pushing it through. And it's frankly, it's going to be up to the popular movements to see that they don't.
And so what happens now with the Olympics coming in 2016? I mean, will they use these facilities theoretically, or are we going to see a whole nother round of this?
Oh, you're going to see a whole nother round because the demands for, I mean, it's so weird because for some reason the Olympics still hold on to this notion that they can only be in one city in a country. So it's like everything is going to be centered on Rio for the next 2 years. And they're going to need a set of facilities, the likes of which the World Cup just doesn't cover, like for the specific events. And you're already seeing that level of construction take place in Rio. There are these, and I talk about this in the book, but they're like these big signs all over that speak in very powerful lettering about how an area is going to look, and all with like these weird slogans on top too. It's like it's a little too Orwellian even for Orwell. Because the slogan of the country is order and progress, and you know, which is in and of itself, you know, sort of makes your skin crawl a little bit. But then like for they do these construction projects where they're tearing down the favelas, and they'll put on top of it like this is what we mean by order and progress, or the future of order and progress. You know, really associating order and progress with dispossession and poverty.
And Rio, you know, I know that under Lula, at least, there was a lot of sort of attempts to deal with wealth inequality. It didn't hold so well in Rio, did it?
No, and it actually, I mean, Lula and Dilma, they've made some serious accomplishments on two questions. One is inequality, and the other is extreme poverty, like starvation level poverty. But the one place where it had less purchase than anywhere else was Rio. Rio was the one place in Brazil where inequality actually got worse in the Lula Dilma years. And the reason for that is going to sound very familiar to maybe a lot of your listeners, particularly those in the New York City area. But the main reason it didn't hold purchase in Rio was because of real estate.
Right.
Because of gentrification, because of, I mean, it's now more expensive to live in Rio than it is to live in the Bay Area of the United States. I mean, it's like you could have a much more affordable life living in Brooklyn Heights than you can living in Rio. I mean, it's just gotten prohibitively expensive, partially because real estate in Rio was stagnant for 30 years, and then starting in 2007, just a speculative boom blew up. And that meant people's eyes got on the favelas, which are largely located on hills. And the World Cup and the Olympics provide a hell of a pretext to go after that land. And because, you know, this has to be said so people understand, like the real estate interests and concerns in Brazil are like the oil industry in the United States. Big, powerful, ruthless, and politically connected.
So and let's talk a little bit about the protests, because these were going on. I mean, I think almost to the year you wrote a piece, I think it was in The Nation, about the protests that were taking place then. And they really have continued more or less unabated.
Yeah, they've gotten more radical and direct action oriented. In 2013 was masses of people coming into the streets, in 2014 is seen more in land occupations, and a lot of wildcat strikes That means strikes that are not done with the approval of the official union leadership. And that's because a lot of the union leadership is connected to the workers' party. So you've had, but when bus drivers go on wildcat strikes in Sao Paulo, that means, I mean, Sao Paulo is the third largest city in the world. I mean, so you're talking like, I mean, incredibly dramatic photos too of 2.5 million people, stranded and you know, flooding the escalators to get into, the underground subway system. And in other words, a very effective transportation strike. And you've seen this also with, World Cup security guards, teachers and firefighters, police. And the slogan that they share is they say, we want FIFA quality wages.
And so what are their chances? And we should add, too, that even Pelé, I mean, I, you know, I'm of the age where, you know, when I grew up, Pelé was synonymous with soccer. I mean, it was the Cosmos, right? And I can't remember what we had in Massachusetts. I think it was the Revolution or whatever it was. But Pelé was huge, not a political figure. Like you said, he was standing with Lula when they announced the World Cup. But he has come out and begun to criticize this, yeah?
Oh, and this is like I wrote this the other week. This is like Nike, like Michael Jordan criticizing Nike sweatshops. I mean, because it's not just Pelé taking a political stand, which is kind of bizarre enough, but it's also Pelé speaking out against the spending priorities of the World Cup. And, you know, I've been asked by folks, like, do I think Pelé is just being opportunistic because he took a lot of heat last year for criticizing the protests? And our response is like, it doesn't really matter whether it's just opportunism or whether he really feels this in his heart. It just says something about how entrenched the dissatisfaction is that even Pelé is saying something.
So you know, and I think, you know, we end all our conversations in this way. I mean, because I know you're a huge sports fan, but I mean, what do people who are going to go and go down to the local bar or watch the World Cup at home, or, you know, I don't know, I guess people, obviously, it's designed for people to be traveling to Brazil from outside of the country. I mean, what should the response be?
Well, that's the right question. I mean, first and foremost, I mean, this is a global event. Nothing unites global eyes quite like the World Cup. And I mean, for people to want to be a part of that, to feel that energy is beyond understandable. And I don't think it's, I would never moralize to somebody who wanted to enjoy the majesty of the World Cup. I would ask people, though, to really stay on your computer and listen to what's happening off the field, because there are likely to be several solidarity calls over the course of the World Cup for people to go to the Brazilian embassy and protest, because people who protest in Brazil, they're going to get gassed, they're going to get shot at. And if Brazil's military police feel like the whole world is watching, they're less likely to pursue brutal ends to stop these protests. So there's a lot people can do. I mean, just but be aware of what's happening. Take the time to take 10 seconds to do a Google search and see if there are any calls that have come out of Brazil to go to the local embassy. And then if they do, take 20 minutes, bring a sign, and tell police hands off, because what we should be fighting for in the United States is making sure that there is space in Brazil for people who want to protest to be able to do so.
And also, people, I think I would add, should understand this dynamic, because this is how playing out in Brazil. But this is a dynamic we see, like you say, in cities across the country, in this country, and obviously across the world. But in this country, we see it all the time, maybe not in the exact same scope or scale. But this dynamic is one that people really have to become aware of more, and you're doing a great job of educating people about it.
Or to put another way, if you protest in solidarity with Brazil, it's not an act of charity. It truly is an act of solidarity.
Indeed. Dave Zirin, author of Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. We'll put a link at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today, Dave. Really appreciate
thank
it.
You, Sam.
All right, folks. Boop, boop. We're going to head into the better half of the program, the funner half. Where the fun half. Oh, we've got such a fun story about, you know what? I got to do this story. This Chiquita Banana story is so fun. Because it really is. I mean, we're going to see this from one angle. But you also have to remember there are people on the ground who the amount of suffering that was involved in the side of the story that we don't see. So the Daily Beast is reporting that a bill which is stalled in Congress, known as the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, which is a bill that has been promoted by survivors of 9/11. It would allow victims of terrorism and their families to seek accountability from companies that finance international terror groups. In other words, giving them a route civilly in which to sue them in civil courts. And which you would think not terribly controversial, right? Unless you are Chiquita Bananas, and for years you were making payments to the United Self-Defense Force of Colombia, which was a drug trafficking ring and a right-wing paramilitary group which had been officially designated by the United States as a terrorist group. Now, Chiquita claims, probably via their lobbying groups and their PR groups, which they are apparently paying almost $800,000 to fight this bill, claim that they were extorted and had to make almost $2 million in payments to protect their employees in South America. Now, the U.S. government didn't buy that claim and fined them $25 million in 2007. In 2003, as of 2003, Chiquita's most profitable operation was its Colombian subsidiary. That year, Chiquita apparently spoke to lawyers in Washington, D.C. and said, hey, these payments that we're paying to this Colombian paramilitary, right-wing paramilitary group and drug traffickers, what's the deal with that? Do we have a problem there? And apparently the lawyer said, yeah, you do. They were told by the lawyers, you got to stop doing it. They did not stop until almost a year later making these payments. Their subsidiary was sold off at that point. The terrorist group, I guess, has since disbanded because maybe their financing dried up. And now you have Chiquita spending $800,000 to fight this bill, which they are afraid is going to lead to civil action against them by families from 9/11. And maybe... And of course, this isn't the angle in this country, but I suspect that when you fund a right-wing paramilitary group that is also big in the drug trade, you are responsible for funding the killing and terrorizing of an untold number of Colombians. So, enjoy your Chiquita Bananas, folks. Well, how'd that song go?
I
Chiquita
know.
Banana, and I'm here to say, I think it was. Yeah.
Bananas are a dirty business.
I'm Chiquita Bananas, and I'm here to say, we're going to stop the reparations bill. Yeah.
I'm Chiquita Banana, and I've come to say bananas have to ripen in a certain way. And when they're flecked with brown and have a golden hue, bananas taste the best and are the best for you. You can put them in a salad.
That's right.
No, not yet, my dear. That green
they can be served by a paramilitary group.
How about me?
Wow.
No, no.
Unbelievable. All right, folks. This show depends wholly on your support. I can assure you that my move to terrestrial radio is no way A, going to interfere with the show. And sadly, I think it's going to be a long time before it helps make this show viable, as I am finding out as we go along in the process. But be that as it may, we rely on your support through your memberships. We give you 5 days a week of content. Almost every day is new. Yeah, I mean, occasionally we go on vacation. Matt and Mike holding down the fort on Mondays to rave reviews, apparently not so great on their spoiler. But I'm no...
I don't want to quibble. I'll just apologize. I don't think we didn't cross the Skyfall threshold, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yes, I understand. But Skyfall was horrible. So, you know, Skyfall was in and of itself a spoiler. Yeah, I said it.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
So it's your members that membership that keep this show alive. You can become a member today at majority.fm. You can also support the show by buying your crap through our Amazon link. Go to majorityreportkickback.com, majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the Amazon link. Bookmark it. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through that link. Amazon's convenient for people. They've got a lot of labor issues as far as I'm concerned. And I'm not terribly happy with their policy on books. But people buy books like Dave Zirin's book there or any, I don't know, gardening, whatever. I don't know what people buy through there. But if you buy your crap through Amazon, buy it through our link. At least you'll be supporting a show that you enjoy, presumably. And also justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Want to be a part of the program? Call me at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be taking your phone calls in just a moment. Also, you can IM me via the app, which you can also listen to the show live. You can also... either download the podcast or stream the podcast. Both. You have the option to do both. Members can log in, get access to the entire archives of the Majority Report, including the extra members-only show. You can get that at majorityapp.com. We'll be back in just a moment. Just a little dog, and she knows I so, if I ask her to walk with me, she shakes her head at me. She's a pretty little doll who says no, 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 no. All the ask her to walk with me. Why can't she ever see me? Says you're only afraid.
ask her to walk. Say no.